There's an old saying in Zen that in the beginning, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And then later on, mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. And still later, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. My own master, Reverend Master Geo Kennett, put it this way. In the beginning, all is different. Then later, all is one. And then again, all is one and all is different. These sayings refer to the course of our Buddhist training. In other words, things change, and they change profoundly over the course of training. These changes take time, and they only occur to the extent that we actually do the practice. Though they take time, and time is necessary, time alone and maintaining body temperature is not sufficient. It takes great time and great practice. What is meant by mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, or all is different? Well, this is the place, the mental place, from which most of us start. Not all, but most. And the practice, the way of training, is geared really to the assumption that we are starting from this place. This is the place in which we know what's real. The way our minds describe life to us is how it is. One could sort of summarize it by, I think it and I feel it, therefore it is so. And things are really quite obvious. I'm me, you're you, this is a chair. What's all this metaphysical fuss about? About people in Zen saying this is simply a dream and there is a greater reality behind that dream. I know when Reverend Master Geo would say things like that, I would think to myself, what a lovely metaphor. But surely she doesn't actually mean it. I mean, I know what's real, and it's this, right? That is a cat. Very fine cat, I might point out. But I am not a cat. The cat is not me. I mean, come on now. All is one is a very nice thing to say, and I understand and feel that at some levels, but it's a metaphor. Well, this state of being, it's more than a state of mind, this state of being is really quite necessary. Some of us in this very room, it would appear, are mental health professionals. There usually are a few. Most priories have them. I can say that because in a former life, I too was a mental health professional. Former life, not so long ago. We know that if in fact a person has the misfortune of never getting to this state of being, you can't really deal with life. Well, you have to get to this state of being. Oh, over the course of your development, you'd have to get here. It's how we function in the world. It's how we cross the street without being hit by a bus. And let me take a moment then and look at some of the implications for life and training of the state of mind of in which mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. In this state of mind, we define or tend to define responsible training and responsible living as taking charge of our life, planning ahead, sitting firmly in the driver's seat of life with a grip on the steering wheel, and guiding our life to where it should go. Training, Buddhist training, Zen training and practice, is therefore a tool. It is a means to an end. And seen as a means to an end, a number of questions naturally arise. The obvious first question is, with regard to Buddhist training, does it work? The first question you ask about any tool, will this do the job? Is this the best tool for me? Is this particular teaching, particular tradition, particular teacher valid? And if it is a proper tool, it is a valid teaching, how long does it take to work? How long, i.e., does it take to get enlightenment? And of course, we have ideas, usually very nice ideas, about what it means to get enlightenment. And then there are some more complex questions that arise. It's actually not simply a tool, it seems to be a whole toolbox. Now, are all the components of the toolbox really necessary? For instance, those pesky precepts, are they really needed? I mean, do I really need another set of rules? Or are they simply cultural baggage that sort of has come along for the ride in the toolbox? The same with some of the various scriptures. There's always one, not always, there's usually one that rubs a person the wrong way. Do we really have to recite it this way? Do we really have to use that word? And then there's all this emphasis in Zen practice on teachers. Not only teachers, but the inconvenient live sort. The dead ones in books are much more convenient. But we seem to have this emphasis on live ones that do awkward and inconvenient things. Do I really need people telling me how to practice? Why can't I just read about it and do it? Why do teachers dress funny and act special? And why should I respect them? And a million other questions. And these are good questions. They're honest questions. And I think that any honest question is good Buddhism, to ask an honest question. Because one of the things which to me is a great joy about Buddhism is that it does not require a priori beliefs. It does not require that we stuff things into our heads. It is the honest search for the truth. And therefore, any honest question is part of that search for the truth and is a good question. And in the state of being in which all is different, and mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, those questions never quite get answered. You never quite can get a completely satisfactory answer out of one of those books, or, I mean, the books are full of paradoxes. And those inconvenient live teachers never quite answer the question. Heaven knows we try, but it never quite satisfies. There is a reason for that, and that is that there are answers to these questions, but the answers do not lie at the point of being of all is different. They come from a different place. And at this point, a minor miracle occurs for some of us in our Buddhist training. And the miracle is that right in the midst of unanswered questions and doubts, some of us actually keep doing the practice. Now, I don't know whether that means that we have unknowingly have faith, or whether we are simply stubborn, or perhaps a bit dim in the head. But some of us keep practicing anyway. And because of that minor miracle, the practice does continue. And because of the fact that this toolbox actually does seem to work, over time, if practice does continue, change does occur. And it occurs right in the midst of these doubts and these questions. For some, the changes occur gradually. For some, they seem to occur in small or large jumps, sort of like quantum leaps. I've never known why it goes one way with some people and the other way with others, and frankly, it doesn't matter. The point is that change does occur over time and over practice. And over time and practice, we come to a realization that all is one. And in this place of being, mountains are no longer mountains, and rivers are no longer rivers. This is the place in which mountains flow, and rivers are as diamond. The place where the life of the river is the mountain, and the expression of the mountain is the river. The place the scriptures describe when they say the wooden figure sings and the stone maiden dances. And here, you and me, and the chair and the cat, are merely convenient fictions. They're thoughts. Thoughts which have a purpose and yet are also self-imposed limitations on an unborn Buddha mind, within which there is no me, there is no you, there is no chair, and there is no cat. There simply is a flow that we are all one with. And that flow has characteristics of love and of compassion which are quite literally awful to behold. And this is seen to be the true reality. Indeed, what we thought of as real in the all is different is a dream. It is a set of mental constructs that have only as much reality as reflections in a mirror. hear what it means to live responsibly and to train responsibly is now no longer to grip the steering wheel and sit in the driver's seat, but rather to give up those things. To set aside being in charge, get out of the driver's seat, and allow a Buddha nature, which is far greater than our abilities to know and to control things, to take its proper place and do its work. And our work at this point is to learn to trust in something greater than that which wishes to grab hold of things. No matter how intelligent and competent that little brain of ours may be. This is the place that Dogen talked about when he said, training is enlightenment. And here, training is no longer a means to an end. The means and the end are one. And in the face of this, all of our previous questions are meaningless. They simply drop away. And indeed, that is their answer. The answer to the questions is that the question itself was unreal. And ultimately, unnecessary, though it was the honest expression of our best training at the time. And those two things do not stand one against the other. Here, precepts, for example, are no longer rules, but they are seen as glowing descriptions of the Buddha mind in operation in this world. They are descriptions of how the love and the compassion of the universe manifests itself in this human world. And it is quite incomprehensible why we would do anything other than follow in those footsteps. Here also, the teacher and the student are one. They are one heart, one Buddha nature, one mind. And one can see the unbroken line of teachers and students going back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And when one does that, one's eyes well up with tears of gratitude. And then another realization occurs, and that is that we are all teachers, and always have been, and all are students, and always will be. As students, it is our responsibility to remain open. As Dogen put it, always be disturbed by the truth. Doesn't mean one is at all times going around in a state of upset. It means one always has the door open to new things and is willing to learn from all things. As teachers, we have no choice about whether we are teaching other beings. We are. Our only choice is what are we teaching at this moment. And that is a most sobering realization. Now, gradually, one gets used to the state of mind and of being in which all is one. And aspects of self re-emerge, as is necessary in order to function in this world. And a new set of questions, therefore, emerges. In the beginning, all questions disappear when all becomes one. Later, from the point of all is one, new questions arise. To give a couple of examples along the similar lines as the questions that arise from all is different. Take, for example, precepts and teachers. Since precepts are descriptions, and since people waste so much time, as I myself have done, mistaking them for rules, and either following out of fear or fighting against, wouldn't it be better simply to meditate and have nothing like precepts getting in the way? Since they can distract us from knowing their true source, isn't it better simply to go directly to the source? Since all are teachers and all are students, why do we make any distinctions between people at all? Distinctions can lead to discriminations and judgments. Why make them? Why discern any difference at all between teacher, student, monk, and householder, congregation member and lay minister, novice monk and senior monk, etc., since they are all one at heart? Why even notice any difference? And these questions, too, are good questions. They are honest questions. They lead one's training onward. And these questions, too, will never be totally satisfactorily answered from the point of view of all is one. But now there is no question of whether or not training continues. Before, it was a bit of a miracle that training continued despite or within the questions. Now it is clear that there's nothing else to do but train. And so we do continue the practice here. Though if someone were to ask us, why do you do this? It might be rather hard put to come up with a sensible answer. It's just the only thing to do. And if we do continue to do that, and do not mistake all is one for the end of training, for that is the danger here, if we do not make that mistake, then training does continue. And over time and training, further changes occur. Again, gradually perhaps, or in small or large chunks. Again, it doesn't matter. We come to a place of being in which, once again, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. The place of all is one and all is different. Here, things are ever so much simpler than we made them out to be. This is the place where the scriptures speak and say, if from the experience of the senses, basic truth you do not know, how can you ever find the path that certain is? It's a place where there's nothing much special. It's simply that as one gives up more and more attachment, and as little bits of self are dropped away, there's simply less there to get in the way. There's less chatter going on inside, and we can trust our eyes to see, and our ears to hear, and our body and mind to sense what's simply there. But this simplicity comes at a price. The price is that nothing can be held onto. And nothing means nothing. Not even the experience of all is one. Not even the compassion and the love, as we understood them, can be held onto. They most certainly are not pushed away or rejected, but neither can they be ours. Neither can we try to get back to them. We simply have to let go at each moment of every attachment of which we are aware. And this is the beginning of wisdom. Rather odd sort of wisdom, given our usual definitions of the term, because it is a wisdom of not knowing. As to what we think of as self, in this place, yes, it will arise from time to time. It's inevitable. We are human beings. Not only are we human beings, but it would seem likely that we will remain so for this lifetime. To fully accept one's humanity is not to get rid of a self, so much as it is to not take it totally seriously. Not to quite believe it, what it tells you. And so we can take our own actions and that of others, and our own illusions and delusions and that of others, our own human limitations, in other words, with a certain degree of good grace and good humor, whilst at the same time not acting upon them more than we have to. Here, responsible training and responsible living can be summarized by an old Arabic proverb that Reverend Master Geo was fond of quoting. Trust in Allah and tie your camel. The trust in Allah part is the all is one. Camel tying behavior is simply doing the obvious. And by the obvious, I mean what you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, sense with your body and mind. That will tell you what is the obvious, what needs obviously to be done next, which is actually quite different than trying to figure these things out and trying to control them. It is an active place, and yet it is not stepping back into the driver's seat and grasping the steering wheel. In fact, it would seem at this point that one realizes there never was a steering wheel or driver's seat to grasp or to be in. Or at least it wasn't what we thought it was. I'm not sure how many of you had such a device when you were a very small child, but I can remember that on my little car seat in my parents' car, there was a small white plastic steering wheel. It had a red rubber center that went beep, beep, beep when you pushed it. And I suspect that I drove my parents half daft, because I would tight grab that steering wheel and swing it around and beep on the little red rubber thing and while we were driving down the road. And you know what? That little white plastic steering wheel was not connected to the steering mechanism of the car. That wasn't what was in charge of where the car was going. It's somewhat like that. The choice, in fact, does not appear to be whether we are in or out of the driver's seat. It appears to be whether we are in or out of the beep beep seat. And we can take Dogen's statement of training is enlightenment, and because it is indeed an equation, we can turn it around and say that enlightenment is training. The very training itself is an enlightened act. And that's what the Buddha did after the Bodhi tree. And that's what Bodhidharma did after 9 years facing a wall. And Huineng and Dogen, my own master, all of them. They didn't sit back and go to bed and eat chocolates for the rest of their lives. They appear to have continued with the very same training and practice that we do. And there is a very good reason for that. Whether we understand it or not, or feel it or not, it is the case that acts of training are enlightened acts. And the training itself is enlightenment itself. And enlightenment itself is training itself. Training, therefore, is not a finished thing. And that is all right. We tend, in the beginning, to want a finish, an end. Maybe because we are so tired of samsara. It's understandable. But training and enlightenment are not finished things. There is no end. And perhaps that is what is meant when the scriptures speak of the goal of goallessness. And respecting the goal of goallessness. So what happens to those questions of ours? Well, again, to take examples, our question about the precepts. All right. Are the precepts necessary? Well, from this place, I would say the answer is of course not. And I'm very glad they're there. Because I'm a human being. And I am not always in a state in which self is out of the way. And I do continue to have blind spots in my training. I can't tell you where they are because they're blind spots. You can help me. I can help you. Because we have different ones. We can help each other. Hopefully, and indeed, it is the case that over time, those blind spots do become fewer. But there's always one or two. And because I am human, I'll take all the help I can get. And the precepts are a great help. The fact that they can be misunderstood as causes of fear, judgment, rebellion, etc., does not mean that they have to be misunderstood. Every wise way of helping beings can be misunderstood. Yet we have to act. We have to do something. We have to be of benefit to beings, ourselves included. We cannot simply sit inert, for that is clearly not to be done. When wise ways, including precepts, are misunderstood, that is sad. And that is human. And that is a fertile place for training to take its work, if we give it a chance. So indeed, it is a place of opportunity, as well as of sadness. We live, as the morning service says, in the actual. With the ideal comes the actual. We live in the actual, not in the ideal. So we do that which is of help, understanding that inevitably it will from time to time be misunderstood and do damage. Same goes with all those distinctions, senior, junior, teacher, student, etc. Are those necessary for training? No. And again, I'll take all the help I can get, thanks. Distinctions do not have to lead to discriminations. Discernments do not have to lead to judgments. Again, the fact that sometimes they do is sad. But distinctions in and of themselves and discernments in and of themselves are of use and of benefit in this world. Lord Buddha distinguished between monks and householders, and he respected both completely. It was a helpful distinction, because all is different and all is one. There is no problem here. Lord Buddha also discerned, for example, the difference between his drinking water and the insects that were floating in it, and prescribed the use of a water filter for his monks to separate the one from the other, to drink the one and liberate the other. That is a discernment. It is an act of compassion for both self and insects. Wherein lies the problem? Discernments do not have to lead to judgments. To live, therefore, with wise discernment is simply to be aware of the all is different within the all is one, and to act simply and accordingly, and to refrain from engaging in the useless mental activities which turn distinctions into discriminations, which turn discernments into judgments. And those useless mental activities are mostly the sort of chatter that comes to our minds when we sit down to meditate, and which we let go of in meditation. Just let go of it. We do the same in mindfulness practice in daily life. Just let go of it. That's all. Just let go. Just don't quite believe it. Don't follow it. And let it go. And the eyes will show you what is real. And the ears will tell you what is real. And the body and the mind will sense what is real. Many questions could still be asked from the all is one and the all is different. But why would we bother? Because it would appear that truth does not manifest by the process of question and answer. It happens through ongoing training and practice in unknowing. We do indeed take refuge in Sangha, in each other, as a part of this. We take that refuge by entrusting one's teachers and one's fellow trainees with the honest state of our being at the time. And sometimes that occurs in the form of asking a question and receiving an answer. But it is not the question and the answer that is fundamental here. It is the entrusting and the mutual entrusting that occurs in the response. In other words, the so-called question and so-called answer are simply doors to a meeting of heart to heart. Right, fair enough. Why do I say all of this? It is not to get you to think yourself into a different frame of mind. Indeed, it is just the opposite. First of all, it is to encourage you to be exactly who you are, to accept what is at this moment. It is essential to accept what is. Because what is what you have to train with. It is indeed your door, your opportunity for training. To wish it were different is simply a waste of the opportunity of what is. All of these states of being, places of training, are fertile fields of training. Just to go onwards and practice and train within any of them is itself an act of courage and honesty and faith. And it will produce good results. So first of all, I say this to encourage you to be who you are and be honestly so. Second, I say it to encourage a gentleness with yourself and with others. Let the mind be gentle. In none of this is there any need for evaluation or judgment or criticism, be it of your own training or of others. I suppose if those things actually helped, there might be a point, unpleasant as they are. But they don't. There is no point. So let your mind be gentle. I say it also to encourage you that if you do find yourself in what appears to be the driver's seat of life, grasping onto a steering wheel, try at the very least to keep a light touch on that wheel. Just let it be in the back of your mind somewhere that just because we believe something or feel it emotionally or think it doesn't necessarily make it so. Just because it appears that life requires that we drive it and control ourselves and control all that is around us doesn't mean, A, that we're actually able to do that, or B, that that is the wise way of proceeding. I say it also to encourage patience. All of this takes time. It takes a lot of time. And it takes training. And it takes a lot of training. Naturally, we are sometimes impatient. That is part of our humanity. We accept that. And remember from time to time that it does take time. This training of ours, this toolbox, actually does work. But it is not magic, and it does not happen overnight. It's like the ripening of fruit. It does not do any good whatsoever to sit under the apple tree and will it to ripen. Given sufficient sun and rain and time and nourishment, it will ripen all in its own good time. I say it to encourage you to be thorough in your training. Training does not work, I say work in quotes, if the training is half-hearted. It is a place where many of us, including myself, start to experiment with Buddhist training and practice and Zen practice. Do a little bit, see what happens. That is good. And one cannot stay there forever. If one simply, for instance, comes to retreats once in a while, or meditates once a day, and then forgets about it the other days of the week, or the other 23 and a half hours of the day, the results will not be what we might hope for. This Buddhism stuff is a way of life. And in the end, there is really no difference between life and practice. So be thorough. Let the training be the life, and let your life be training. And above all, I say this to encourage you to keep going. Simply and honestly doing the best training you know how at this moment. In the end, that is what is required. Because to do that will lead to everything else. Everything else that I have spoken of today is led to, simply and inevitably, by honestly doing the best you know how and keeping doing it, moment by moment, day by day, year by year. It is not a coincidence that the great mantra of the Heart Sutra, Scripture of Great Wisdom, says, O Buddha, going, going, going on beyond and always going on beyond, always becoming Buddha. Gyate, gyate, hara gyate, hara so gyate, bodhi sovaka.